I think people can get informed about our healthcare system and the changes that are necessary. I think that they can follow the Universal Healthcare Governance Board. I think they can talk to their legislators. I think they need to get involved in the political process that has people working towards healthcare for all. So I think that there is, I think people need to be in, get involved in the political process in the state.
And perhaps the recent changes, massive cuts enacted, will galvanize some of that support.
I think that's the hope. I mean, I think that's perhaps maybe a little bit of the silver lining.
Well, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, thank you so much.
Juan Carlos, a pleasure. I look forward to more conversation.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.fm, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today we consider the new BFI monograph on Luchino Visconti's The Leopard. But first we get a double dose of Jeff Godsell's Essentials of Cinema, starting with History is Made at Night.
Andrew Serres called it the most romantic title in the history of cinema, and it was directed by one of its most prolific romantics. Frank Borsagi had made nearly 60 films, 40 of them during the silent era, when he made History is Made at Night in 1937 with Charles Boyer and Jean Arthur. Despite being a two-time Oscar winner, Borsagi was then languishing at Warner Brothers, being given mostly trivial projects like Dick Powell and Ruby Keeler musicals. When producer Walter Wanger approached him, he jumped at the chance to do History is Made at Night, even though all they had to begin with was the title and a couple of pages of script. Jean Arthur plays Irene Vale, unhappily married to wealthy ship owner Bruce Vale, played by Colin Clive in his second-to-last film. Vale is maniacally possessive of Irene, bitterly jealous, and falsely accusing her of infidelity. Irene has had enough and tells him that she's seeking a divorce. Vale learns that he can block the divorce if he can provide evidence that she's been involved with another man within 6 months of filing. He arranges for his driver to go to Irene's hotel room in Paris and pretend to be her lover, whereby a private detective will catch them in what appears to be an uncompromising position. But unknowns to both of them, an unknown man has been watching through the window on the balcony. He bursts into the room defending Irene, and in the struggle, the driver ends up on the floor, unconscious. When Vale and the private detective burst into the room, the man threatens them with a gun, demands Irene's jewelry, and takes her away as a hostage. Once in a taxi, fleeing the scene, Irene is astonished when the man returns her jewelry, explaining that due to the circumstances, he could tell that something was up, and some quick thinking allowed them both to escape. The man introduces himself as Paul Dumont and invites Irene to dine with him at the Chateau Bleu, and she accepts. But as they arrive, they find that the restaurant has closed, and the chef, as well as the small orchestra, is just leaving. But Paul, played by Charles Boyer, is not without charm, and he seems to have some clout. He persuades them all to return inside where the two have a lovely dinner and they dance the night away. At this point, History Is Made at Night has dipped into distinctly different genres, the suspense film and the romantic comedy, and it isn't finished yet. The ease with which Borsegi is navigating us is reminiscent of Lubitsch, even if the dialogue is less scintillating and the humor a little less wry. By the end, we'll be diving even into the disaster film, with an ending that wasn't even written until 2 weeks before it was shot. But what is perhaps the most impressive thing about History Is Made at Night is that even with all of these unpredictabilities during the production, it is unmistakably a Frank Borsegi film, fitting perfectly into his canon and standing out as one of his best. But back to the story. It turns out that Vale has killed the driver that night and convinces everyone that it was the unknown man who was the murderer. Vale blackmails Irene into returning with him to America. Paul, it turns out, was the head waiter at Chateau Bleu, a considerably high position in France. When he learns that Irene has returned, he embarks for New York, along with his good friend and chef, Caesar, played delightfully by Leo Carrillo. There, they rehabilitate a restaurant in Manhattan, making it one of the best places to dine in New York, in the hopes that Irene will one day walk through those doors. This single-minded determination is typical of a Borsegi protagonist and evidence of what Serres called his belief in love over probability. Irene does indeed come to dine, along with her unsuspecting husband, but their happiness is short-lived when Paul learns of the driver's death, believing that he was responsible. And when a different man is arrested in Paris for the crime, Paul feels compelled to return to Paris to clear the man's name. Irene insists on going with him, and the two travel on the Princess Irene, the very liner owned by Vale and named after her. When Vale learns of this, he goes into a rage, ordering the ship's captain to run at full speed to break the record for the fastest crossing ever, despite the danger of icebergs. Sure enough, the ship collides with an iceberg, and news reports indicate that the ship has sunk, with a death toll potentially higher than the Titanic. Even though it is what he had hoped for, Vale becomes consumed by guilt, committing suicide and leaving a note confessing his murder of the driver. But miraculously, the bulkhead doors manage to contain just enough water on the ship to keep it from sinking. The lovers are saved, and the future awaits. There is plenty to admire in History Is Made at Night, not the least of which is how the leads, both Boyer and Arthur, have never looked so natural, so free to express. It is as if, at least for one film, they were able to soften the edges of the typecasting that had nonetheless deservedly made them stars. There's a playfulness to Boyer in contrast to the dark, brooding foreigner that he so often played, including the picture he'd just finished, The Garden of Allah, with Marlene Dietrich. And what is remarkable is how, even with this hodgepodge nature of the script, Borsegi was able to mold the film in his artistic image, the very definition of the auteur theory, and to invest his characters with the same unwavering belief that romantic love is the highest objective that a human can aspire to. For Borsegi, this was a given. Even though they may not even say, "I love you," their commitment is unquestioned, their desires certain. Like Gary Cooper and possibly Borsegi's masterpiece, the 1932 A Farewell to Arms, Boyer displays an uncomplicated sense of purpose, admirable in its determination. The audience, like Irene, has no choice but to surrender to its truth. Despite being called one of Hollywood's most romantic directors, Borsegi never spoke of love in platitudes. He didn't even refer to his films as love stories, but rather human interest stories. Actors loved him as he encouraged them to act like, well, people would. His films may not have been as sophisticated as Lubitsch or as funny as McCary or La Cava, or as earnest as John Stahl, but they contain some of the best elements of all of them. And History Is Made at Night is no exception. I strongly recommend the Criterion DVD of the film, featuring some great critical and historical discussion, as well as an audio interview with Borsegi from 1958. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
So KABU is now in the middle of our spring membership drive, and we are trying to raise $60,000 by the end of this month. So we'd like you to go to KBOO. This just in. Now go to bit.ly/KBOO to subscribe to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Once again, that's bit.ly/KBOO. Do it today.
Next, Jeff reminds us of W.C. Fields and It's a Gift.
Back in the late 60s and 70s, there was a kind of a revival of some of the great film comedians of the 30s. The Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields, and Mae West were being discovered and appreciated by a new generation. Their films were popping up at festivals and college campuses. Their popularity was attributed by some to their irreverent, and in the case of the Marx Brothers, even anarchic humor. It seemed to fit the new counterculture with its anti-establishment point of view. And while there's some truth to this sociological explanation, a better one is simply that most of their films were still funny. You didn't see a revival of, say, the Ritz Brothers or Wheeler and Woolsey because, quite simply, their films were not. Revisiting these iconic clowns today, the best of their films are still funny, even if their names are brought up less and less with each new generation. Sadly, the one that seems most to be fading, with the general public at least, is W.C. Fields, although most contemporary comics know and love him.
How do you do, sir? Can you sit down?
Manicure?
No.
Haircut or shave?
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. Isn't your name Flug?
Yeah.
I thought so. I didn't recognize your face when you first came in.
No, it's all healed up since I was in here last.
Did you know you had your hat on backwards?
Oh, no. Oh, thank you very much. I had it on backwards day before yesterday, and a friend of mine came up and kicked me in the stomach.
Hey, what's that dog doing in here?
Oh, it's a very funny thing. The other day, a man was in here, and I was shaving him. The razor slipped, and I cut his ear off. The dog got it. Ever since, he's been hanging around here for... Go away, go away, go away.
Fields was 50 years old when the talkies arrived. And by then, he had already been in show business for over 30 years. First as a juggler, and then in vaudeville, and with the Ziegfeld Follies for 6 years. Fields even made a dozen silent films, surprising considering how verbal his comedy is. All the while, he was creating and perfecting his comic persona. While sometimes showing a mean streak, especially toward children and dogs, Fields was at his best as the henpecked husband, trying to get by, but constantly at odds with everything and everybody. In some ways, he was the Larry David of the 30s, always getting into scrapes, some of which weren't actually his fault. With his roly-poly stature and bulbous nose, Fields remained lovable, and if he liked to have a nip now and then, well, who could blame him? Fields' drinking was legendary, and he was able to work it into his characters quite well. Many of his sound films are just reworkings of routines that he had been perfecting for years. The screenplays, such as they were often constructed by Fields himself, using his colorful pseudonyms like Otis Kribblecobless and Mahatma Kane Jeeves. While many of his films contain priceless moments, his best, It's a Gift, from 1934, is perfection from beginning to the end of its tight 68 minutes.
Open the door for Mr. Merkel.
What?
Open the door for Mr. Merkel, the blind man.
How about my kumquats?
What'd you say?
Kumquats!
Wait!
All right. You got that door closed again, huh?
I'm awfully sorry. Come on, this
way.
Don't do
that.
Wait,
look out! What's that?
It's all right.
Think nothing of it. Just little glassware.
What?
Just little glassware.
What's the matter with you? Can't you talk?
Here's your pipe, here. What can I do for you?
Have you got any chewing gum?
Yes, we have.
How about my kumquats?
Coming.
Fields plays put-upon grocer Harold Bissonnette, or Bissonnet, as his wife prefers, and as Fields tries in vain to correct many others. It's Harold against the world, but fortune seems to come in the form of an inheritance. With this, Harold can make his dream come true. He buys a plot of land in California where he and his family can retire with an orange grove, just like the one in the photo that he's been carrying around. It isn't long before it's discovered that the land is worthless, but not before some hilarious vignettes involving a display of light bulbs in the store and a blind and deaf customer, as well as Fields' attempt to get some sleep on his balcony, only to be interrupted in the most improbable and unfortunate ways. The family heads out west in their old jalopy just the same, getting into a couple of scrapes along the way. Looking at the beautiful California landscape en route, Mrs. Bissonnette starts to warm a bit, thinking, well, maybe this wasn't such a bad decision after all. Well, all hopes are dashed, however, on arrival, when they see that their new land is a barren plot with a rundown shack and a tumbleweed. How can this end well? Well, in a W.C. Fields movie, it can and will. As a car pulls up and a developer gets out, desperate to buy Bissonnette's land to put up a grandstand next to his new planned racetrack, Fields pulls out his well-worn photo of his dream orange grove. That's what he wants, and that's what he gets. Fields appeared in 5 movies in 1934. Then, after appearing in David Copperfield as Micawber in 1935 in a stroke of casting genius, Fields' output waned. Heavy drinking and chronic illnesses were taking its toll. After his last film for Paramount, The Big Broadcast of 1938, Fields was physically unable to appear for long on a set. It was radio that kept Fields' career alive, appearing several times on the Bergen and McCarthy show, developing a long-running mock feud between him and the ventriloquist dummy Charlie McCarthy. Writers had a field day with McCarthy targeting Fields' bulbous red nose, while Fields would remind McCarthy that he was made of wood. His health somewhat returning, Fields enjoyed a major late-life revival when Universal signed him for the films that many remember him best for. After You Can't Cheat an Honest Man came The Bank Dick, My Little Chickadee with Mae West, and finally the surrealist Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, featuring the movie within a movie, with Fields pitching his thoroughly ridiculous screenplay to the studio. Wacky as they are, these later films relied a bit more on slapstick for my taste, and they just can't compare with the comic perfection of It's a Gift.
I want kumquats!
Coming! Oh, almost forgot the chewing gum.
Where's my gum?
Here's your chewing gum, 5 cents, please.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lug that with me. Send it.
Oh, yes.
Harold?
This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for even more recommendations. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And now let's reconsider Visconti's The Leopard with the help of the new British Film Institute monograph on the film. Back in the 1920s, the lord of magnificence and expenditure was Erich von Stroheim in a series of epical films set within European aristocracy, such as The Wedding Party and several others. He explored the mores of the sort of people that one would think his Vaughn indicated were his milieu. His extravagance included having various characters wear exquisite underwear despite the fact that the audience would never see it. Sadly, this extravagance inevitably led to a clash with the studio, MGM, and his career was slowly dismantled, not unlike that of Orson Welles in the 40s. And yet, 60 years later in Italy, Luchino Visconti evinced much the same extravagance. There is an anecdote in which Burt Lancaster, the lead player in The Leopard from 1963, walked over to a clothes bureau, opened the top drawer, and found an array of expensive handkerchiefs, towelettes, and other sundries on display, which may or may not have been used in any scenes. Visconti was never punished for this excess, and instead enjoyed a fruitful career, not just in cinema, but with over 60 plays in the theater and almost 20 opera productions. The evidence suggests that Visconti simply did it correctly. After all, in the 60s, numerous studios such as Warner Brothers, MGM, and Fox, at least, were in free fall, mostly because they continued to offer viewers movies as if it were still 1952. And the slaughter continued. Michael Cimino is blamed for the total destruction of United Artists, to riot an understatement, thanks to his film Heaven's Gate. Indeed, the company that released The Leopard in Italy, Titanus, itself collapsed shortly afterwards, but due to a film released the previous year. Lancaster's anecdote is referenced in the new British Film Institute's Film Classics monograph on Visconti's The Leopard, which proves to be one of the best books in the series, not simply for the simplicity of its organization, but for the wealth of detail found in the volume. Author David Weir is associate professor on the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, and is a specialist in James Joyce, the subject of decadence, aesthetics, and European cinema, among other topics. Visconti was a scion of an aristocratic family. Indeed, he was a count, but at the same time, he was a dedicated communist. That he could believe one thing and make a different kind of movie is explained, Professor Weir quotes him, Archibald Colquhoun, who translated Lampedusa's source novel into English and worked as a dialogue coach on the film, captured the contradictions in the director's sensibility when he observed that Visconti, quote, thinks left and lives right, close quote. And that was Professor Weir quoting another writer. The book is divided into a handful of chapters. The first gives a summary of the source novel, Lampedusa's The Leopard, published in 1959, its reception, and Italian history in the years around 1860, pertinent to the key narrative transitions. The next chapter charts Visconti's increasingly period set and operatic style dramas, beginning with his near realist phase, then moving forward through the more extravagant productions up until 1963. The next chapter concentrates on the production of The Leopard itself, which is where we find the Burt Lancaster anecdote. And the following chapter digs into the meat of the film, a scene-by-scene, sometimes even shot-by-shot, consideration of what the film's unconventional plot and narrative are getting up to. For example, if you want to know why Tancredi, the nephew to the prince played by Burt Lancaster, first appears reflected in the prince's hand mirror, here is the answer. If you are curious about the reaction to Claudia Cardinale's laugh after Tancredi tells her a blue story at a mammoth dinner party, the moment is anatomized here. If you didn't notice something significant about the last few seconds of the film's final shot, here is the reminder. Finally, the book covers the film's legacy, its immediate impact, its influence, and the various international directors who found inspiration in the film, such as Martin Scorsese while he was making The Age of Innocence, and Coppola while shooting the opening wedding reception in The Godfather. Importantly, Professor Weir notes that the busy, antic, contemporaneous films such as Fellini's Eight and a Half seemed to reflect the vitality of counter-Hollywood cinema of the time, but The Leopard, over the next decade, became a true model, with its stately pace, its structure as a series of operatic sequences without the interstitial linking that the traditional screenplay insists upon for clarity, he explains thus, quote, "The Leopard is in many ways the apotheosis of traditional filmmaking, involving high production values, big name stars, a best-selling novel as the basis for the script, and of course a celebrity director, but it appeared before the public at a time when the elements of traditional filmmaking were coming into question. Indeed, Fellini's 8.5 achieved critical acclaim and commercial success partly because it raised doubts about the very nature of traditional filmmaking. That said, the reception of The Leopard was no prediction of its legacy. Critics and audiences may have delighted more in Fellini's absurdist send-up of the movies in 1963, but in the years to come, ever fewer films would look and feel like 8.5, while more and more would come to resemble The Leopard. To a non-Italian, indeed, to a non-European audience, the film would probably seem baffling, slow-paced, and irrelevant. For one thing, one has to know a great deal about the Italian unification movement of the mid-1800s, as the film is set within these events, but does not explain them contextually as a normal Hollywood screenplay would. In addition, the film is a series of sequences, somewhere between 15 and 20 of them, with a few flashbacks inserted, that simply charts the seemingly innocuous doings of the prince's family through the course of a few years. For added heft, the film concludes with a 48-minute sequence set in an annual fete in which the prince wanders from room to room, gauging the decline of his aristocratic society into mere greed, self-promotion, and political manipulation. The lowest point occurs when he pauses in a room joined to a small vestibule stacked with bedpans and bedpots, haphazardly stacked, each filled to the brim with urine. Here is how Professor Weir concludes his book, finally returning to the key concept of decadence, which he introduced in the first chapter. Quote, "As awareness of the political conditions that so charged the reception of The Leopard in the 1960s continues to recede, its aesthetic appeal makes it look more and more like a heritage film. The comparison is made easier by the proliferation today of big-budget prestige productions, such as Peter Morgan's The Crown, Julian Fellowes' The Gilded Age, and perhaps even the second season of Mike White's The White Lotus, filmed at different locations in Sicily, including Palermo. The latter explores the excesses of super wealthy American tourists who indulge in vices ranging from adultery to murder at an absurdly upscale resort. It's over-the-top depravity, making it different from Morgan's more restrained but still sensational send-up of the aristocratic misadventures of the British royal family, or Fellowes' tempered narrative of the wasteful wealth and social ambition in Belle Epoque, New York. What they all have in common are the high production values and the cultivation of the voyeuristic tourist gaze of heritage cinema, qualities that The Leopard shares. But at the same time, these later-day big-budget productions remain, after all, small screen, devised for streaming on a television or even a smartphone. A far cry from super technorama, to say the least. One of the best capsule definitions of decadence is decline at its peak. And while Luchino Visconti's The Leopard will always occupy a privileged place at the heights of all the aesthetic refinement and social corruption the best decadence entails, part of its legacy includes that lesser decadence so prominent in our own declining times." Close quote. And that was the conclusion of Weir's BFI monograph on Luchino Visconti's The Leopard, recently published. Well, there you have it, and thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with